everyone, it's Wednesday, and recently I decided to release an episode every once in a while to give you a little magic or a little miracle in the middle of the week. So every once in a while, you'll look at your subscription and you'll think, oh my gosh, it's not the weekend, but it's because I've decided to release an episode when you least expect it. This inaugural Midweek Miracle episode features Kendra Lockhart, and she has some really interesting stories to tell. You know, there's one that just blew my socks off for when she was a gemologist and had to hide all these diamonds or gems underneath her clothes to deliver them. But that's the least of the stories she shares this week. Not only did she work in that vocation, but she tells stories of training for ballet really rigorously when she was a kid. She has so much that's so interesting, but ultimately her story is about finding your truth later in life and owning it. Recognizing who you are, what gifts have been handed down through your lineage, and embracing them. Her story is one of reconciliation, recognition, and responding to the invitations that life has to offer. She's really quite a phenomenal human being, and I will provide a link to Kendra's Instagram so that for those of you who are interested, you can check out a little bit more about this amazing human. So now, here's your midweek episode, episode 155 of Bite-Sized Blessings.
It was more that my half-brother and I were unattended at my grandparents' pool in Florida. It wasn't a big one, but it was quickly deep. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't shallow and then a tiny bit of a depth. He had bitten a hole in his floaty device. I remember being in the pool and trying to splash water over my head so I could get under it, and it wasn't working. And I heard a calm and peaceful voice say, pull the chair over to the corner, exhale, jump out into where he is, grab him, pull him up. And it made perfect sense to me, even though I must have only been 8 or 9. And I saved his life.
How do you self-describe if you were going to introduce yourself?
There's a before and after to who I am in the world. And we all know that COVID changed a lot of our roles and identities. So my old life up until 2020, I was your private jeweler. I was your goldsmith and gemologist. I was the one who made 10,000 rings. All of my clients were easy to get out of bed and go to work for, because who else could possibly say that I am surrounded by people who are in love with each other? But I started having an idea a week before lockdown. What do I want to do next? So that got answered for me loud and clear. We all went into quarantine, and who I am in the world now is I am the metaphysical monarch. My brand is Know Yourself Well, and I help people awaken into their soul level through intuition, divination, and shadow integration boot camps, workshops, and courses.
Yes, it's very interesting how the pandemic kind of subverted all our expectations, kind of swept our feet out from underneath us, and hopefully most of us emerged on the other side with a little more clarity, a little more compassion for others. I know a lot of people have been talking about just, they're not going to know for 5, 10, 20 years, you know, the social and cultural implications of the pandemic and the lockdown. You know, one of the things I've noticed is that people are a lot angrier. And I think, you know, being sequestered away from society, or feeling like your life is stymied, is super challenging for a lot of people. I loved not having to go out on the weekends. I loved staying at home, reading a book. I loved watching movies. It was a great time of introspection and
kind of revelation for me, and rest, deep rest. I'll never forget when my ex-boyfriend's mom came over, and she was just such a Tony person, just like dressed immaculately all the time. And she just started wearing sweats all the time. And for me, that was like a revelation. I thought, who is this person? But cool, like groovy, that she has this side to her that I've never seen before. And so I think, yeah, the pandemic brought out parts of ourselves that maybe we keep hidden, some good, some challenging. I don't know. It sounds like a really enchanting and magical time during the pandemic where you completely revisioned who you were.
That's the word for it. I really spend most of my life up in my soul. That can be challenging for introverts. And so when the pandemic came, I thought, yay, independent study for everyone. I can go off and do what I want. And then coming from a military family, which plays into the humor part of where this all began, I took full advantage of being in a bubble and seeing which part would fall away and which part would emerge. And obviously that sounds so fairy tale and so perfectionistic and fabulous, like a rom-com or something, but no, it had a pain point. I got to see a lot of the anger in my friends. I lost a lot of friendships that were decades long because of the expectations of how we were supposed to be and how we were supposed to support each other. The lifesaver that got thrown over a ship is a person in my heart who, when I was trying to figure out what to do with all this, I had been teaching Pilates classes before. I'd been running around making rings. I was designing for your wedding. I was restoring your grandma's heirloom. When he said, use everything you've got, I thought, well, there's this secret I have. There's this piece of me that I really don't show very often. And you got to be in the club to know this about me. And that's when I began and said, it's time for visibility, because I am here to pay forward the people who helped me normalize living at that high frequency, the way I'm built, not the sum total of my skills and my experiences and my education and getting really good at art.
Yes. And I was going to ask about, obviously, I mean, not obvious, I shouldn't take anything for granted, but I mean, you're talking about working with jewelry and being a gemologist for quite a long time. To me, that just screams artist.
Thank you. I mean,
when you were a kid, were you drawn to things that sparkled or that were golden? Or how did you get into that vocation?
Part of it was how I needed it to be. And part of it was being exposed to what my dad did. He was a dental lab tech. So as a kid, I went to the lab with him and I watched him carve teeth and cast them in gold. And it was very medical as far as the exposure. My dad and I both share a very strong math science part of our brains, as well as the creativity. And when dreams of being a dancer and a performer and all of that went to the wayside in high school, the next best thing is to start from what you already have a couple layers on instead of from zero. And as many times as I've reinvented and freaked out, it's like, oh my God, shoots and letters, I'm back at -5,000. No. And I would ask the audience to question, is it really zero? Or does it just feel unfamiliar and a setback? Because I'm still resting on skills that are part of me that just need to drive now.
Gosh, I have to tell you, just hearing your stories about creating these probably exquisite, one-of-a-kind creations, I would be so nervous. I would be so scared, because I'm sure some of them were quite expensive. And True. And also, you know, as you said, heirlooms. So, but, you know, with the eye or the vision to hand that piece down through the generations as this kind of exquisite memory, set in gold or silver or whatever they choose to comprise that piece with. But I commend you for your bravery in working with those really rare metals and rare gems. I mean, I don't know if I have the guts to do that.
You know, thank you for getting that layer of it, because a lot of people don't have the depth to understand how much precision it takes. But as somebody who lived through almost 15 years of Ballet Academy, you train into being able to do risky, precise moves. And if you're proud one day and you blow it because you're not warmed up, that's how that went away for me. But one of my funniest stories is the first year I was a diamond courier, I was more nervous about carrying $40,000 of center stones back downtown than I was restoring somebody's heirloom piece on the bench. And my boss at the time said, dress inconspicuously. And so the next day I showed up in my flannel pajama bottoms and the shirt I did all my painting in, because I was going to be taking public transit in Chicago. And he said, I said inconspicuous, not homeless. I looked awful, but I was so scared to have it pinned inside me. But back in the day, that was the romantic side, like the streets of New York and it's turn of the century and I'm a newsie and it just, or it's under your hat. I was insured and you just had a little bit of a trust fall. And so that became very normal. And what became very anxious, anxiety building was having $100 in my wallet then. So it really is just the way you move through the world that will give you your faith and your fears around taking chances.
I have to tell you, if I was a diamond courier, I would be over like hyperventilating in the corner. I couldn't do it. I would totally. Also, I just want to put this out there. I took ballet when we moved overseas to Pakistan, and I was so sloppy. I mean, I was just like sloppy, and it was so precise. And the teachers, bless their hearts, were trying to wrangle all these young kids, right, to put on Cinderella, ballet of Cinderella. And, you know, I was the only, there were no boys in the class. I had very, very short blonde hair, and to my mortification, was made the prince in the ballet. I think that has, I still remember this decades later. I can't let it go. I cannot let it go. But man, I just was too sloppy to continue with ballet. I'm just a little more messy than ballet. So I also commend you for being a little more careful and a little more dedicated doing ballet.
Well, thank you. On the opposite end of our axis is I'm a nightmare at the nightclubs because I don't have choreography. So when I get out there, I can't just be all interpretive and spontaneous, and I don't have a go-to moves. But one of these days we'll trade places. We'll see how the other half live.
Sure. I'll get out of my chair. My knees will kill me, but I'll limber up after a little bit and we'll see what happens. Well, I would love to know, did you grow up in a religious household? What did that look like in your family?
It is pure comedy. It's 24 karat gold. This is the best thing ever. And it's where I first began to know that as much as we're all trying to get away from religiosity and any sort of scar tissue that comes with that package, I love that I can anthropomorphize a higher power into a bit of a comic, because I was that witty and funny kid. That was my coping mechanism in such a structured family. My dad is a Vietnam vet. My mom is the kid of a military wife and a World War II vet. So there's not a whole lot of fast and loose between my two parents. And then out comes me, the fireball. They put me in Sunday school as quote unquote free babysitting. My parents are atheists. And the joke's on them. It was one of my dad's friends who was a Sunday school teacher. His name was Jack. And the guy played banjo, and he was just a real nurturing kind of gentleman. He was definitely a very beta personality. And I thought, well, ha ha, I love songs of victory and coloring animals on boats. This is the best thing ever.
I did love when I had to color in the story of Noah and all the animals.
Right.
Loved
it. Game changer.
Loved it. Yeah. So I get it. I get it. I think that's really funny.
It's hilarious because then, you know, it became such a piece, not at an identity level. I was 6 years old. I wasn't running around saying, now I'm a Christian. It just became so important and was fertilizing. What I do now for people is create a simple and easy awakening process or recall process, depending how far away you are from your soul body. But once we moved away and it was too much of a drive to go, I wasn't angry in the pandemic. I was angry at age 9. And I remember being home. It was Easter weekend and Jesus Christ Superstar came on. Now, mind you, we're really into Ballet Academy now. It is no longer just the 6-year-old who can't figure out right from left. And so when one of the critical scenes came on, I went over to the wall and just had a fit. And now, again, the context of my house, we weren't really allowed to misbehave. So I shot my shot. I went over to the wall and I kicked it at the top of my lungs and said, I want to go to church. Pow! And my dad, there was no consequence to that. He got the message loud and clear. My mom had plenty to say about it, but before you know it, we were looking for a youth program for me. And I grew up with a half brother. I was the only one who had the spirit and passion for it.
And the babysitting skills.
Yes. Yes. And through my teen years, it became such it just opened me up in ways that school couldn't. Even though I was a champion academic, I was an artist, I was an athlete, there were all these identity things happening, but beyond that, and that's why I'm a metaphysical facilitator now, is that was being seeded, watered, fertilized, nourished, and grown in me. And I went through the youth program. I had a brilliant confirmation. Over my wall, I still have my benediction and promise from when I got confirmed. And I began to give myself the permission to even outgrow this. It's kind of like when you grow up in a small town, this is only part of it. There's more. I need to go on the adventure.
I love that. It sounds like a little bit, I mean, it just reminds me, only because I grew up during this time, of Footloose, you know, the guy in the small town dancer. Nobody else wants to dance or is allowed to dance. And basically he comes in and just changes everything. Something so simple. And sometimes it is just something that simple that can change your entire life, right? Jesus Christ Superstar, you're watching on TV. You have this reaction and it changes everything. I think that's fascinating. And I love that story. But what I really love is that your parents honored your wishes, right?
They tried not to, and it didn't go well for them, and it didn't go well for our family room door either. So, there's two different ways that I use the word magic. There's the experiential way and the existential way. I was always a very spiritually sensitive kid. Having had so much war experience in my family, my great-grandfather died in World War I and left my mom's dad's mom, my great-grandma, widowed. She raised him alone. He grew up and went to war. He came back, had my mother. She married my dad. They met on my dad. Where he was supposed to go for naval training was shut down due to meningitis. And so he had to, instead of drive to the Chicagoland area, he had to drive to our major airport and fly out. And my dad's one of four boys. And my mom punched his ticket and he started walking away. And we all laugh. We do the air quotes. We go, something tapped him on the shoulder. Something stirred inside him. I've had people call it their guardian angel. I've had people call it their intuition. When I do boot camp, I break down what the word psychic can and usually doesn't mean or contextualize. He turned around and went back to her and said, "Can I write you? Can we correspond while I'm gone?" And she said, "Sure, my dad's a veteran." And they were a long distance letter situation for about 18 months. I believe that helped me be sensitive to what we consider magic. And as a kid, I remember knowing it was almost tactile. I was clairsentient. I was very aware there were presences in the space that I couldn't see that were not of my own imagination. I remember being told things that would later be proven true that there's no way I could have studied. They were beyond my years. There were moments where I was, quote unquote, divinely guided to do things outside of a strong adrenaline burst and jump into action. I'm a small person as a full adult. I'm 105 pounds soaking wet. The number one magic moment that I tell people about isn't the messenger spirit that was in my bedroom that would tell me of the seven souls that were to be my friends as I would grow up, that would give me pieces of my hero's journey and my individual awakening quest. It was more that my half brother and I were unattended at my grandparents' pool in Florida. It wasn't a big one, but it was quickly deep. It wasn't, it wasn't shallow and then a tiny bit of a depth. They were very athletic grandparents. So it was a tiny little ledge of here's where you can stand and then whoop, and here's the diving end. And he had bitten a hole in his floaty device. And I remember being unjustifiably upset that I had to keep taking swimming lessons. And all he had to do, my mom's little messiah boy, my mom's love child, I was the hate child, got to drop out. And here he was putting himself in jeopardy. I remember being in the pool and trying to splash water over my head so I could get under it, and it wasn't working. And I heard a calm and peaceful voice say, "Pull the chair over to the corner, exhale, jump out into where he is, grab him, pull him up." And it made perfect sense to me, even though I must have only been 8 or 9, and I saved his life. And, of course, we all have to snap back into our human awareness. And the adults came running. He's crying. Suddenly I'm the dick because I wasn't better watching. You're not supposed to be an 8-year-old watching a 5-year-old swim. But the fact that an 8-year-old accomplished this. So I had many, many experiences since then like that. But that was the one that really, I can't remember what I ate for breakfast. But I am back in my grandparents' pool. I can even remember the condensation on the greenhouse style rooftop. It's a space and not a time that I can go to.
Well, and what's really astonishing about your story is that you heard this voice and it immediately was a solution, right? And you were trying to get underneath the water to get him, which, if you're still learning how to swim, is a scary prospect as a kid. But here this voice was like, "Go get the chair, jump in, and it'll propel you far enough to get him," which is just, that's a lot of responsibility for a kiddo, to have to save their brother. But there was no one else there.
No, they were all in the front room drinking, socializing, eating, any of the above, who knows, planning what hotel to stay in. I don't know, but there wasn't a single adult with two kids in a pool. And that story is not a one-off. There are plenty of stories that you either see in movies or that there was an accident by the lake, or there was a celebrity's son who drowned in their own private swimming situation. Just it's not rare. But what's rare is the fact that there was a successful outcome. And as soon as I experientially, existentially knew that voice, it set into motion. It almost is like when you break a glass, pieces go everywhere. And yet it's still a whole if you add them back up. There are other moments where I had that same dialogue and knew without being trained what to do and not do. And so through the art of Buddhism, I did take the Bodhisattva vow. I am willing to be a steward in the awakening and the elevating of the consciousness of people who are aware they have a consciousness and are struggling or suffering. And so in our strange backwards way, I am still that kid who wanted to continue a legacy that was happening to me in the spiritual environments I was being placed in.
As a child, you know, you have this experience with your brother in the swimming pool. Did you think to yourself, all right, like something has my back, or I have a special friend, or is this being going to come back? Did you ever wonder about that?
It was becoming a pressure cooker in the family dynamic. My dad had lost his job, and as a solution, I had to go and become an entrepreneur instead of be part of a firm. And I think there was a piece of me that probably chose not to remember a lot of that, but it did not ever cross my mind that was, there was an aloneness and not aloneness. There are two different layers to that. Aloneness simply is situational, even if it's by your choice. Loneliness means there is a need unmet and there is some sort of identity struggle with having to substitute a plan B it. There are a lot of plan Bs in my life, but the number of times that it seemed like this is now part of how I will grow until further notice. There were so many other stories like that. And my half-brother, you can tell we're not of the same blood. There's definitely, we don't have a lot in common. And that's not because I want to use that bias. It's simply, if you look at us, you can tell these two are not quite family. And for my level of high perception and coming from all the Lockharts who seem to be savants at something or seem to be, I won't say old souls, but are just clearer, sharper, more present, wiser. It wouldn't be the last time that the kid I watched grow up under my roof would make some really terrible life choices and get himself in some really harmful situations where I kind of became this lifeguard to his soul and putting him back on track. I remember we were over at my dad's business partner as he had gone into entrepreneur, and we were playing with the man's German Shepherd, and I got this extreme spike, this hot flash up my spine, kundalini for lack of better words. And I went in the other room and I told both my parents, I said, the dog just bit Chad. And they looked at me like I had just, you know, said, I want to drink a piss milkshake. You know, they had this look on their face like, okay, not great. We're just going to pretend that wasn't said. And then you hear this bark, this scream, and Chad comes out holding the same knee that I was holding to show them. So there is what I call, you can blip into a spiritual space and out of incarnated or human time. And so that became normal for me, on demand for me, and highly developed for me in my youth.
I was going to ask if you, I mean, I don't know, this is a challenging question, I think, or an interesting question. When you were a kid, did you feel like you were given a choice? And if so, did you, I mean, it sounds like you walked towards it. As far as utilizing these powers or inhabiting these spaces, sometimes when you're a kid, you don't even know that you've signed some contract or agreed to something, but it sounds like it was a pretty fabulous superpower to have, even though everyone else around you was kind of grumpy.
Oh, I have more than my fair of social faux pas with what I call the normies, having mystical experiences or predisposition towards the abilities that come from being sensitive. I was busy loving it, and yet there was a definite type of exile. You know, you're not going to walk into every room and be instantly relatable, or the conversation. You've learned to have grace and respect around people who don't want to hear it, or people who are afraid to mention it. I've learned to come up with entire vocabulary buckets to help people phrase it to me that works for their level of belief in it. And I'm glad that after decades, I expected to have to hide this for a long time. I'm the first person on my dad's side who has not chosen to bury it or to fight myself around it. And I believe I'm changing that generational pattern. I believe that's where I am, that trailblazer. And I hope that it heals him. He just recently came back into my life.
Well, depending on the situation, varying degrees of very scary, putting yourself out there, hard work, commitment, compassion. It just invokes all these different capacities in all of us. But what a beautiful story. And thank goodness, right?
Absolutely. And it's rippling through the life of my cousin, who in 21 years has become a mother and is now starting to close the gaps between him and his brother that were never the two brothers that were the closest. He's found in his storage unit pictures of my grandmother I never met before I was born. It is unshattering that same glass. All the pieces now are coming back together. If we're playing the tapes backwards, into a whole integrous, unified moment. And he must have been doing his own work too. All those years that I spent grieving in advance, when I walked in, he burst into tears, or he welled up. I mean, I can't be hyperbolic. Burst into tears later when we were done reconnecting, like two people who just picked up where they left off. But even better, because growing up, I was 30 years younger than him and a kid. I'm still 30 years younger than him. And now he's the friend I always wanted and was getting instead of a dad. And in this time and space, it's perfect. It's ideal. But when I walked in, he said, "I always knew this day would come." And I said, "I thought the last time I saw you was going to be the last time I saw you." And he said, "I love you," and kissed me on the cheek. And how do I say it? It was a spontaneous healing for both of us. Could we have been egocentric about it? Could we have pulled out receipts and been like, "All right, now we're going to go through and audit this. And, you know, and you did this to me 1, 2, and I do this to you 3, 4, and gone into patterns and righteousnesses." Sure. We both know we don't have that time. And I think he over there has had 21 years to get to know himself well and has had an incredible awakening. He's giving me my letters back from when I went off to sports camp. Not all of those are fun to read because I realized, wow, I was incredibly bullied 7 weeks away in northern Wisconsin. These are not fun to read, but they also showed me my grit. I'm not going to swear on your podcast, but one of these letters I wrote, "I wish I was having a better time. At least a couple times a day, someone tells me to F off, bitch." And I went, "It sucks and I'll figure it out." And I thought, What a tenacious little 12-year-old who has no friends at this place and is going to get thrown to the wolves and come out their leader. Like I said, I've been baptized by fire plenty of times.
I was going to say, I find you resilient.
There's that. There's one phrase that I love in my dad's side of the family. They were originally from Minnesota. They all loved winter sports and, you know, definitely not a sexy part of my life, but I was a junior curling champion. And clearly that did not get me my golden ticket to being, you know, the girl next door or whatever. But there is something to be said being exposed to that upper state influence. I live, my mantra is that Wayne Gretzky phrase is, you miss every shot you don't take. And so I didn't come this far just to come this far.
That's the end of our first Midweek Miracle episode and my interview with Kendra Lockhart, who on Instagram is known as the Metaphysical Monarch. There will be a link in the episode show notes to Kendra's Instagram, and you'll find a lot more about her super groovy stuff, her podcast, Know Yourself Well. She just started it a few months ago, and she's really interviewing some really intriguing and fabulous human beings. So make sure to check out the episode show notes so that you can find out more about this glorious human being. I need to thank the creators of the music used this week, Kevin MacLeod and Sasha End. For complete attribution, please see the episode show notes. All those delicious little items will be there. Kendra is a prime example of someone who discovers later in life that the gifts that she used as a kid are still there for her to access. And she's using them each and every day, whether it's with family members or those she encounters out in the world. And she's making this world a shinier and better place. And so my question to you is, what gifts did you have as a child? What gifts are you no longer claiming that are your birthright? What are you hiding? And how can you use what you're hiding to make this world a better place? Thank you for listening. And here's my one request. Be like Kendra. Recognize your gifts, those that you're born with. Reclaim them. Work on them. Strengthen them. Work them out just like you'd go to the gym. Make them a little stronger. Claim your childhood gifts. And then go out and make this world a shinier and better place.